Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. A recent study from the Journal of the Association for Consumer Research suggests that a smartphone, even when it's sitting silently face down on the table, can be a significant distraction that limits cognitive function. So you can imagine the effects when our phones are constantly buzzing or beeping with push notifications. Senior staff writer for Wired, David Pierce, recently wrote about these modern-day annoyances. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, thank you for having me.
To start on the same page, let's explain exactly what a push notification is and when they started showing up on our smartphones.
Sure. So a push notification is basically anything that just sort of appears on your phone. It's that thing that lights up your lock screen or buzzes your phone while it's in your pocket. And it can be anything from an email to Yelp telling you that there's a new restaurant you need to check out to a text message to a phone call. It's really anything that finds you on your phone as opposed to you finding it. And it's been around for a long time, really ever since BlackBerry in the early aughts started to do this with push email. And back then it was great. Because it said rather than having to check your email every 5 seconds just to make sure you're not missing anything important, you can actually go and live your life and trust that your phone will alert you when there is something you need to see. But unfortunately, that idea of something you need to see has been sort of co-opted and ruined over the years.
It's not everything is a must-see exactly when you must see it.
Exactly. And it turns out, I think, this experiment that I've done with my own push notifications has proven that it turns out almost nothing is a must-see anymore.
The push notification started with emails. So now what do you consider a push notification?
Now it's really unbelievable how many things want to send you push notifications. Any app you install on your phone, whether it's a game or a messaging service or a way to browse the internet or a shopping app, all of these things want to send you stuff. They want to tell you that there's a new in-app, purchase that you can buy. You can buy new levels in the game, or there's a coupon that you really must have right now that's so exciting, or some exciting new world happening in this app that you just have to be part of. And it's news alerts, and they're just bombarding you because all of these apps and services desperately want you to use them. And what they've discovered is that they essentially have a way to yell at you, metaphorically, anytime they want. And there's just no incentive for them not to do it all the time. And so all of these services do.
Out of curiosity, then, if these apps want us to link to them, what does that do for the app company? The number of people who engage, what does it do for them?
Yeah, well, so we're at this point right now where there are all these apps and services that are supported by ads. So every time you open an app, that's good for the company because they have one more, daily user that they can report as a number to investors or to Wall Street. They have ads they can sell against you. You go in and, maybe you do buy the in-app purchase and in Candy Crush or whatever game you're addicted to, you go in and it is genuinely exciting when there are new Candy Crush levels. So it's just part of this constant suck towards your phone. And it just quickly reaches this point where you really don't ever get a moment of solace because something, whether you need it or not, is buzzing you. And the problem is when your phone vibrates and you're not looking at it, you have no idea what it is. It could be the most important text message you've ever received in your life from the person most important to you, or much more likely, it's Yelp telling you that a new restaurant opened 3 miles away that there's absolutely no reason you need to know about, maybe ever, but certainly not right now.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking about smartphone distractions and push notifications with David Pierce of Wired Magazine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Is it simple to turn these off, David? That would seem the logical way to be able to have a little more control over your life.
Yes. So there are two things you can do to sort of mitigate this challenge. When you install an app, ordinarily what will happen is it will ask you if you want push notifications. And I think like most people, but maybe I'm just the worst at this, tend to just sort of hit, allow and yes and okay. And just, you sort of hammer away at all the pop-ups just to make them go away so you can start using the app. But if you don't do that, if you're a little more careful, you can prevent it initially from ever sending you push notifications, which is good. Or once you've turned these all on and decide you want to reclaim a little bit of your time and attention and go turn them off, you have to go into the settings on your phone and go app by app and turn them off.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're somebody like me, I have, you know, 100 apps on my phone. That takes a long time. And you have to go in and there are tools you can use to manage them. You can have it so that you get notifications, but it doesn't make sound, or that they don't turn the screen on, or all these different things. But it's so much work to manage them. And then you have an app like Facebook, which you can go in and say, you know, send me notifications for this, but not this. But then the next day, Facebook will invent some new kind of push notification and opt you into it. So it's this constant game of whack-a-mole to try and manage this, which is why for me, for this piece I wrote, I landed on this idea of basically the easiest thing to do is just turn all of them off. It's so much work to manage them and get them right. And honestly, it's so little benefit to do so that you might as well just full scorched earth, just turn them all the way off.
Well, are there any push notifications that you would consider useful that you wouldn't turn off?
Yeah, I think everybody has a few that are really important. For me, it's things like text messages, because that's how people I care about tend to contact me. Or if you use apps like WhatsApp, or if you care deeply about Snapchat or Instagram, like everybody has, I think, a small handful of apps where real people are trying to reach them. And that's sort of become my rule, is that if you don't want to turn all of them off, leave on notifications for apps and services where actual people that you know are trying to reach you, and turn off all the other ones that are some like faceless machine writing algorithmically generated copy to try and get you to buy new things in an app. All of those can go. You don't need them. They're a waste of your time and attention.
Because there's little incentive for these companies to have you change those applications. They want you to use them.
Yeah, there's this really fascinating thing happening in the advertising world where all of these brands will write blog posts and give presentations about how we have to be respectful of our users and we have to make sure that people don't uninstall our apps. And the theory is that if you send somebody too many notifications, they'll just uninstall your app, and that's a disaster for these companies. So hopefully that's going to work, but it doesn't work. And then the flip side of all these studies is that it basically – there doesn't seem to be much of a ceiling at which people will finally take some action. And so what they've found is that if you just send more and more and more, even if people open fewer and fewer and fewer, they're still going to open more because you're sending them more. And Google and Apple are happy when they're using your phone, and Yelp is happy when you're using Yelp. And so all of these companies are just going to fight harder and harder for your attention, not less and less.
It's if you could redesign this... How would you do it?
Well, I think in theory, if you go back to sort of what BlackBerry was trying to do all those years ago and then apply modern technology to it, you could have this really interesting world in which your phone sort of exists in the background and you have all these apps and all these services going on, and your phone is smart enough to actually know what you care about. It has all your data, all your information, all your behavior, and it could say, okay, you know, David's at work, so I'm only going to send him things that are related to him being at work right now. And that does not include new Yelp businesses, for instance. Or David is traveling. Maybe I will send him more Yelp things. And you could have this thing that's actually built to give you what you need at any given time, as opposed to just blanketing you with push notifications all the time. So there's a world in which this idea works. But the problem is we're just so far away from it right now.
I was going to say, that's almost a little scary that it's reading your mind as to what you want to know just by what you do.
It is a little bit scary. And I think if that world ever comes to pass and your phone becomes so sort of proactively brilliant, I think that might be a little scary. But the reality is all that data is out there. Google and Facebook and all these companies know so much about you that they could be much smarter about what they choose to sort of push in your direction at any given time. But they just don't.
They just don't. Let's look at the larger picture here, because I mentioned one study at the top of this segment. You mentioned a couple in your piece about how distracting smartphones can be. Are they actually bad for productivity and attention span? I would think, based on the way I am, that that's true.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question right now. I think we spent a decade, really, ever since the first iPhone came out, allowing ourselves to be enveloped in these phones. And we love how many things we can do on them. And they let us be connected to our friends and family and work all the time. And I think we're finally at a point, both as users and sort of as a tech industry, where we realize that's not all good, that having something in our pocket that does everything, that is our conduit to everything, is equal parts exciting, and frightening. And we've become, in a really real way, addicted to our smartphones, and they're engineered to keep us addicted to them. And so I think we've finally reached what I think is a really exciting place where we as users are starting to rethink what that relationship is supposed to look like, whether we are supposed to be sort of drawn into our phones all the time, or whether they're supposed to be more like tools that we use when we have a job for them and then are able to leave them alone otherwise.
And do you really see people doing that? Leaving them alone?
It's happening really slowly. There's been this interesting movement towards new devices. There's this device called the Light Phone, which is basically just a rectangle of plastic with a bunch of numbers on it. It's like an old flip phone, but it has this sort of cool minimalist Bauhaus-y design. And the idea is it doesn't do anything, and it just makes phone calls, and that's it. And for a small segment of people right now, that's really exciting, because you get this sense of, you know, if somebody really has to reach me, they'll be able to. And otherwise, not only am I not going to use Twitter, I can't use Twitter. And sometimes that's actually a really good thing. And these things are very slowly, I think, starting to percolate out as we realize more and more sort of the real grip these things have on us, and how much that's not us. That's being done to us as users. It's really smart engineers fighting against our single, you know, primitive brain trying to figure this stuff out. And we are losing that battle. And it's time we fought back. And I think people are realizing that.
What I think they say is it's a shot of dopamine every time you hear the buzz or the beep or something that you think needs your attention. And because it has become almost addictive.
Yeah, I mean, it's the equivalent of pulling a lever on a slot machine. And there have been studies that found that it's actually winning is really exciting on a slot machine, but so is pulling the lever, just because of the anticipation of something good happening is so exciting and so enthralling. And it gives you such a shot of dopamine that it makes you want to do it again. And notifications are the same way. Every time your phone buzzes in your pocket, something in your brain goes, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the most important thing that's ever happened. Everything's amazing. And then it never is. It's always nonsense. But that feedback loop just keeps you going and going and going, and makes it really hard to get out of this cycle of constantly obsessing over what's on your phone. I'm guilty of this too. I'll be at dinner and not need to be at work. Nothing else matters. And my phone will buzz in my pocket and I won't check it. But all I'll be thinking is, man, I wonder what that is. I bet it's exciting. And it takes you out of where you want to be. And that's such a bad thing.
I think we can start by taking care of those push notifications. And again, your advice is to take that time out of your day once just to do it.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. It's probably, you know, 45 minutes of sitting there and sort of stupidly thumbing through all the settings on your phone. But I've talked to a lot of people since I wrote this piece who have gone through and killed most or all of their push notifications. And every single person I've talked to has said that they feel better for it. And I certainly do. So I can't recommend it highly enough.
Well, if we can take any stress out of our life, even from our phone, we should do it, right?
Absolutely.
David, thank you for joining me today. David Pierce, senior staff writer for Wired. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan. Smart technology is integrating with nearly every aspect of our lives and showing up in some unexpected places. Even something like winemaking, which has been perfected over thousands of years, is being hacked by tech-savvy wine enthusiasts. Smart vineyards are using sophisticated weather sensors and supercomputers to turn grapes into better reds, whites, and rosés. Tech news site CNET has been sending its reporters far and wide to explore the diverse ways smart technology is changing the world. It's for a series they're calling The Smartest Stuff. And joining us now by phone is CNET's editor-in-chief, Connie Guglielmo. Hi, Connie. Welcome.
Good morning.
You sent a reporter out to find the cutting-edge processes in the wine industry. And as a person who loves wine, I love the fact that something new is up and coming. What's going on?
Yes, we sent a reporter to Napa and Sonoma Valley here in California to see what kind of tech these wineries are using. Obviously, there's a lot of tech already being used today in all sorts of businesses, and wineries are no exception. But a lot of that tech has been used at a very superficial level, like for your business apps and, you know, running your employee base, et cetera. But we found vineyards that are really taking the idea of monitoring every aspect of what they do from the minute that they plant the grapes to the fermentation process and techifying it, if you will.
And meaning techify it by data that they collect and put into their, quote, supercomputer. What are they getting from this data, and where is the data coming from?
Yeah, let's talk about one of the vineyards that we looked at, Palma Vineyards, which, again, is in the wine country here in California. They built a 100,000-square-foot facility, 18 stories deep, which is built around a supercomputer that's tapped into their fermentation tanks that tell you every aspect of the fermentation process in real time. The data is actually projected on a dome overhead so that you can see the temperature, the sugar levels, all the other metrics that you will that winemakers instinctively know about. But they're charting it at a level that has never been done before, and that's all to perfect the perfect glass of wine. Winemaking is an art, and it's, as you said, been going on for thousands of years. But winemakers are looking for an advantage in how to get a better vintage. And really, wine is all about consistency, right? You want to have a vineyard that produces amazing, you know, top-selling, beautifully finished wines year after year. And so it's that quest for consistency that they're after, and that's why they're using all of this data analysis. And not only during the fermentation process, Palmez sends a drone plane out over the vineyards every Thursday to take a look at the temperature and the condition of the vines. Are they getting too much water? Are some areas not looking as healthy? Is there a bug infestation that they can spot ahead of time? Really using technology to monitor and control every aspect of the winemaking process.
Wow. Now, have there been any bottled wines that have gone through this whole process so that they can see whether or not what they're doing is making a difference?
Actually, we'll see the first vintage next year. The early tests, they tell us, are very promising. But the first commercial batch will hit the market next year, which is why we wanted to go and see exactly what they were doing. That is a huge investment, and I encourage anyone who's out on the West Coast to try to take a tour because it does look like a James Bond underground villain's lair.
It sounds like it. 18 stories deep. That's amazing.
It is amazing to see.
Oh, but you also talked about the growing process. I would think that I almost might be more beneficial because the weather is something you don't have control over, and this might let vineyard owners have a little bit more control.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to grapes, the soil conditions and actually how much rain the vines are getting is a very important piece of information. In California, where we've just gone through a drought and are hopefully coming out of it, I mean, this is critical to the success of any crop every year. So understanding at a precise level exactly how much water that particular vine got is data that then allows them to adjust their watering or to say, oh, wow, the Zinfandels are not getting enough water. We need to, you know, triage right now as opposed to walking past a vineyard. And again, winemakers are very sophisticated. They know their art. But having that extra level of information can mitigate problems ahead of time. And you can spot trends. You can start to see, wow, we need to start working on things. You know, winemaking, like most businesses, is very, very competitive. And so if you can stem off problems, and I don't mean a pun there, but if you can avoid problems ahead of time with adjustments, like I said, in something as important as the water levels, then that's a huge, huge advantage.
You called winemaking an art, which I think many people believe, also a long, deep tradition. Is there resistance then by some to this technology, thinking the old way is the best way?
Of course. I think that is a universal truth when it comes to technology, that it doesn't have all the answers. But if you think about big vineyards, and I'm not talking about you planting a couple of, you know, vines in your backyard and wanting to try to produce a grape, big vineyards, again, are all about scale and trying to get to a level of predictability and quality and consistency. So anything that's going to give you that advantage is worth looking at and studying. Paul Maas, I think, with their underground James Bond villain lair, has taken it to an extreme, but it's a fascinating one because technology only gets less expensive as the years go by. We have open source software, that is software that people can adapt and use pretty readily. So this portends what it's going to look like in the years ahead. You're going to see more technology in wineries, whether or not they believe in the advantage of tech, because it just makes good business sense.
Right. I would think that if you can catch a bug infestation early on, that would be a boon, you know?
It absolutely would be. And then you would spot it in your fermentation tanks, thanks to the data feedback you're getting in terms of the bacteria levels.
Will all this really lead to better bottles of wine?
Well, that is certainly the hope. You still have to know what you're doing in the winemaking process. You have to know your blends, and you have to know what the taste characteristic of the wine needs to be. So you can't abdicate your winemaking to technology completely. But as I say, people like Paul Maas are trying to get to a level of a consistency maybe faster than it would take through experimentation in their fields. And if they are successful, that means more investment in their winery. That means more grapes grown, more bottles produced, more jobs. So it's a virtuous cycle. And at the end of it, you get to have a glass of wine.
A glass of wine. Well, you're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking about smart technology in winemaking and other aspects of our lives with CNET's editor-in-chief, Connie Guglielmo. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Now, another thing you looked at as part of the Smartest Stuff series was high-tech meditation. Earlier this hour, we talked about how distracting smartphones can be, so it does seem counterintuitive that meditation technology would go together with your phone, right?
Yes, that's what we found. And I can tell you, my poor reporter that had to go to some meditation sessions and visit spas for this story, she wrote in the story, it was probably the best assignment she's ever had in her life. We are completely stressed out by our tech. And as you noted in the prior segment, people are fixated with notifications in their phone. There's also that idea if you don't have your phone with you and you think it's in your pocket, it's phantom vibration syndrome. You think it's buzzing, but it's actually not there.
I have heard of that, yes.
That's how attuned we are to our devices. So we wanted to understand, what are your options for meditation? So we sent our reporter to traditional spas for your, you know, basic massages and workout sessions. We sent her to a Zen retreat in Marin County here in California, and she sat in a yurt and communed with nature and spoke with people. But the best experience she had was in this meditation pod called the Soma Dome. It's a machine that costs about $14,000, and now spas are starting to incorporate it, and companies here in Silicon Valley, Adobe has bought one for their employees. And basically, you get a 20-minute or so session with light and sound therapy. So what does that mean? You lie back during your workday in a pod with very softly glowing lights that are intended to affect your mood. Green brings inner peace. Violet contributes to spiritual insights, and soft music plays, depending on what you're trying to achieve in that 20-minute relaxation period. You want introspection, you want quiet time, you want to lower your blood pressure, and then you just listen to voices and music. And I think the fact that it's very directed, that is, there's nothing really else you can do in a meditation pod except to enjoy the experience, really has had an impact on the stress levels of the people who are using it, which is why our reporter has been lobbying heavily for us to get one here in our office in San Francisco.
So she must have liked the experience.
Yes, she really did, because she tried the other experiences as well. As I said, she went to more traditional kinds of relaxation programs, and those also have their benefits. It really, this is an individual thing, but not discounting tech. We wanted to see if tech could help solve the problem of tech stress, and it turns out that it can. There are tons of apps that you can download for your phone, some free, some that you can pay for, that do all kinds of things. The one that I always think about is the Apple Watch has a free app called Breathe that wants you to remember to breathe. Which is a kind of a funny thing when you think about it, because it's something that normally you don't have to tell people to do, but it's the kind of breathing that you're doing, right? 4 seconds in, 10 seconds out. That helps elevate or help reduce the stress and bring on that sense of calm and peace that you're looking for. But there is a lot of tech, not just biomonitors that check your feedback, but that are intended to switch your brain and get you to take a step back from your day. The Soma Dome is a completely, you would see that in a sci-fi movie, right? People lying
right
down. You don't walk out with a tan. You just walk out in a very good mood.
But, you know, it seems stressful to me, not relaxing, especially if you're the type of person that suffers from claustrophobia. You are closed in, and that could be stressful, too.
Sure. And it's not for everyone. In that case, you might want to go to the yurt or have a massage. But the idea that there are ways and that people are exploring technology to help you de-stress from tech, we thought that was very interesting just from the get-go. But that it's effective, that is much more interesting to us. Some of those apps that I'm talking about,
yes,
obviously are on that smartphone device that you cannot put down. People have a fear of leaving their smartphone and walking away with it, and it induces stress. So if you can add a piece of tech that can remind you, yes, you're carrying a smartphone, but you don't need to freak out about it every time it buzzes. Let's take a minute of your day or 3 minutes of your day or whatever you want to designate to just remember to relax and breathe, or stare off into the distance and contemplate something other than the demands of the news cycle that are bombarding you with news that's freaking you out.
You know, I know what you're talking about, these apps, though. There was a relaxation app, and it had visuals of the ocean and beautiful scenery, and you had the sounds of nature, and that's all it was mm-hmm. to give you a feeling that you weren't sitting in a room, but you were out experiencing nature, and it was just basically called like a relaxation app.
Yes, and you're going to see that kind of technology evolve. We've also been looking at virtual reality, where you can have an experience and you are taken completely to a different place, and that you feel that you're in a different place. The problem with the VR experiences today are that they're very computery. You know that you're watching a made-up scene, basically. But there are companies that are working on these kind of seamless experiences where you don't even know that you're, or you forget, let's say, for a few minutes that you're in a VR world. And that was one of the other stories that we did for a smart series. We visited a studio here in south of San Francisco that wants to be sort of the Pixar of VR presentations. And they have a VR presentation that takes you to a forest and you feel that you're walking in nature, just as you said. But there's another one where you're given the power with wands that you hold in your hands to create snow. And our reporter thought it was so lifelike that she was disappointed when she reached out to touch a flake and it wasn't cold. Just
wow.
For a minute. So that's just the beginning. We're just at the very start of those kinds of VR presentations and technology. So you can expect that that's going to get better in the coming years. Right now, VR is a clunky way to do it because you have to wear headgear. That can be uncomfortable for some people. And as I say, not all the presentations are seamless or as immersive as you would like, but certainly the stuff that Baobab is doing, that snow scene that I described, gives you a hint of, wow, this is really going to change in the next few years.
Well, and apparently leaders in the tech industry like this idea of mindfulness and trying to create more realistic versions of this because they want their employees to be part of it. And you alluded to that when you said some are putting these meditation pods in their offices.
Absolutely. A lot of companies in Silicon Valley get ridiculed for having, you know, the lunch yoga sessions. Adobe has the Soma Dome for its employees, which, by the way, is booked every single session.
Mm-hmm.
Our reporter had to find time to squeeze in to go down and use it. And other kinds of meditation breaks, because what happens, as you and I both know, if you're tired and stressed out, you are not as productive as you should be. It might take you four times as long to do something that you could do normally, you know, very quickly. So taking that break, whether it is yoga or sitting in a Soma Dome or listening to an app with birds chirping or finding yourself immersed in a VR experience. That's all beneficial. We spend a lot of time worrying about what we put into our bodies in terms of what we eat, right? No carbs, all carbs, protein, what have you. But we don't spend as much time worrying about our mental health, and that is something that tech companies are very aware of. They're not the only ones. I think many companies offer some kind of wellness, but of course here in Silicon Valley, people are pushing the edge of what that all means.
Those are millennials too, and isn't that important to that group of people?
Absolutely. Work-life balance, mental health, focusing on yourself for part of the day is definitely a part of what the millennial generation finds appealing about how what they bring to work, the kind of energy that they want to bring into the workplace. But honestly, all of it. If I were to tell you, you could have 20 minutes in the Soma Dome as part of your once-a-week break, you would probably do it just because it is a break. You're off your
feet. I might try it. I'm still not sure I can get over being enclosed somewhere, but I might try it, especially if the light and things makes it feel more open than it is.
Well, you don't have to close it completely, right? You can you can adjust it. It is not like you're underwater in scuba gear at 20 feet down. You can pop out at any point. So having that level of control, I think, also might help you.
Connie, good stuff. And I'm sure your reporter had a wonderful experience. I understand it was a good, as she said, a good assignment. Connie Guglielmo, thanks for joining us. And she is CNET's editor-in-chief. We'll be back with more Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Gail Hogan. Many tech experts agree that one of the most exciting emerging technologies that will shape our world is augmented reality. Similar to virtual reality, augmented reality allows users to overlay information and graphics into our view of the real world. All the major tech companies, including Google and Apple, are developing their own versions of this technology. Joining us now to talk about augmented reality and other tech news, and we have a lot on our plate today, contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holly. Hi, Russell.
Hi.
Augmented reality. Explain it more, because I'm not sure that by just saying overlaying information into the real world is a good explanation, but I'm not sure how else to explain it.
Sure. Yeah, it ends up being kind of complicated because it's not just one specific thing. But the way that most people are going to see it here in the next year is going to be looking through your phone as though you were going to take a picture. So you're seeing the camera view on the back of your phone. And instead of seeing just the real world in front of you, there will be kind of virtual objects that are going to exist. Kind of through your phone as this kind of window into another world. And so you're seeing, some of this will be educational, where you'll be able to see specific landmarks and information on those landmarks. Some will be entertainment, a game that you'll be able to play on your coffee table that only you and your friends can see through your phone, but it's actually happening, it's playing out on your coffee table, and just dozens of other things that developers are working on that we haven't even seen yet.
What would be, you said, kind of for education, but what also would be some uses for this? I mean, I see it as you talk to the phone and say, I would like to see the inside of the state capitol.
It's certainly possible. What we're going to see here as we move into the next year is how Google and Apple are going to take augmented reality and kind of work it into the way that we're currently using our phones. So, Apple's big approach for this coming year is being able to take things that you would normally see on your phone, maybe a picture of a space, that around you, or a particular virtual object. Maybe someone has taken a 360 degree photo of something, and instead of needing to put on a virtual reality headset or something like that, you will be able to use your phone and kind of see these specific objects as though they were, on the table in front of you, or, on the yard in front of you. And it will, give you these kind of different visual ways of exploring something. So instead of just looking at a two-dimensional image, you're able to actually take steps in the real world around this sphere and see, you know, this object from all of the different perspectives as though it were actually there in front of you.
Wow. How close are we to this? I mean, between Google and Apple?
We're very close to it. This is something that has been, you know, it's been in development through many different companies for the last 10 years as a way to make it, you know, so that it's something that fits in your pocket with your phone and is actually comfortable. And Google and Apple are approaching this from two different perspectives. Google wants, you know, something that is very technologically advanced so that it's, you know, has this, you know, it's not just aware of the single object that is right in front of you, but the phone itself is actually aware of the space in the room so that you're not doing things like walking into walls accidentally or, you know, so that the virtual experience that's created actually fits in the room and doesn't look distracting by kind of hanging halfway out of a room or something. Whereas Apple's experience is to put it on every single iPhone as quickly as possible so that, you know, developers can reach just this massive group of people and figure out what works and what doesn't, which has very much been Apple's way of doing things in the past. And so what we're going to see with the next iPhone is just this huge kind of land rush of apps where developers work on you know, new storytelling techniques where, you know, instead of a traditional movie, you know, you would actually see kind of the entire set play out in front of you, and you'd be able to walk around that set and see, you know, all of the different angles from each of the different people that were there, for example.
Oh, my God. So for Apple, they want to make an app. Google wants to make something that would actually attach to the phone?
Well, Google wants to make it, you know, has specialized hardware called that they call Tango sensors. That are built into several different phones now and more phones later in the year. But it's just those specific phones that you go to buy, the most recent of which being the Asus Zenfone AR, which is at Verizon now, where you would buy this phone and there are apps on it that only work on this phone that they give you, you know, really kind of impressive what's called spatial reasoning, where you can look at the solar system. And it is scaled in real world so that when you say this space right in front of me is where I want the sun to go, and the phone will tell you that Neptune is 25 meters away from where you just put it and is aware of how far away 25 meters is. So as you're walking, the phone is actually aware of how fast you're walking and how close you are to that to Neptune in this kind of massive you know, spatial mock-up. And that kind of thing won't be possible with Apple's AR kit, but what you're going to get in exchange is just this massive ecosystem of people who are able to use these kind of smaller scale augmented reality things.
How would augmented reality help us in our daily life? What's the idea behind it that we would find it useful?
Well, the very first example that we saw, and this is going back probably 7 years ago, was this app called Layer. And it existed on Android phones and iPhones. It never worked very well because the phones really just kind of weren't ready for it at the time. But what it promised to do was give you the ability to hold your phone up, and it would place landmarks that you'd be able to see through the phone for things like popular restaurants and gas stations and things like that. And so imagine being in kind of a big city and having never been somewhere before, and instead of having to look at a two-dimensional navigation map, you'd actually be able to look through your phone and see, you know, a guided arrow to the destination that you're going and be able to follow that and have it be just kind of much clearer as you're walking through a city is one potential example.
This is going to be interesting to see where this all ends up.
It is, and that's going to be the big thing. You know, this is all going to start with the next version of the Apple operating system. So when the next iPhone comes out, not only is the new iPhone going to have it, but it's going to be available on a lot of the older iPhones as well. And so that's, you know, really once that starts, you know, in either September or October when that phone is released, there's really going to be just a massive number of these augmented reality apps in the Apple store. And the biggest question that a lot of people have right now is whether these are going to be kind of cute things that people end up using for 5 or 10 minutes at a time and then going back to using the normal apps that they have on their phone, or if it's really going to change the way that we use a lot of the apps on our phone. And that there doesn't seem to be a consensus on that yet.
No, I think sometimes it's how it's developed as people use it. And you can't
tell
until people see how it fits or doesn't fit into their life. So that will be something to watch for. You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, and we're talking with Russell Holley, contributing editor at Android Central. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513. or email allsides at WOSU.org. In other news, Russell, Microsoft has released software that lets people control their computers with their eyes. This fascinates me, and I can see so many ways for this to be definitely useful. How does it work?
So this works. This is a combination of hardware and software right now. This is something that Microsoft has been working on for a long time now, but it uses a special camera that you would attach to the top of your computer. It's called the Tobii Eye Tracker. And it uses these kind of specialized both infrared and normal camera sensors to see where your eyes are looking on the screen, and it uses that to give you a lot of different options. You can you can look at specific icons on your screen and have it basically act as though you were double clicking on the screen. You can have it set to as you're reading a web page, as you look further down on the web page, it will start to scroll for you. Instead of requiring you to scroll a wheel or touch a tap pad, it would just move for you as your eyes read down the page. And there's a lot of work with other developers to put a lot of other features into this. And it's going to be a lot of experimentation for a while. But this whole idea is really, not just from a kind of day-to-day use standpoint is kind of fascinating, but also from a usability standpoint. People who do not have full access to their limbs for what would be considered kind of traditional computer monitoring. This is a really big step.
And that was going to be my thought. How folks with disabilities might be able to use this if they don't have that ability to use their hands, use their arms to text or email.
Yeah. So there's been for quite a while some accessibility tools that allow differently abled people to use computers for a lot of different things, but they're often very expensive. They're often, what would be considered medical grade equipment, and not always very easy for people to set up. I've been in environments trying to set them up myself, and they're very complicated to get functioning with good reason. They have to work very well in those environments, and this is kind of very new. And does not work quite as well as those things. But you're talking about $150, which is much cheaper than some of these other pieces of equipment. And it really does so far work very well as far as being able to set it up and kind of use your eyes as the mouse on your computer.
This is already on the market then.
You can buy the Tobii Eye Tracker from Amazon right now, and it's the software to help run it is part of the Windows 10 Fall Creator Update that came out very recently. So this is something you can start playing with right now, but be warned that it's still very much a beta thing. When it works, it's very cool and it does work pretty well, but it is far from perfect yet.
You need a special camera then, apparently.
You do need that special Tobii Eye Tracker camera. And, this is the kind of thing where as Microsoft continues to work with it, it's entirely likely that we will see a lot of Microsoft's partners start to build these kind of cameras into laptops and desktops. So if this ends up being something that works very well, then over the next year, we will see this kind of technology just, kind of ubiquitously existing in computers.
Well, the question is, will the keyboard go away in the future? And it'll be all voice or eye.
We keep trying to kill the keyboard, and
if
it takes our eyes to do it, then...
But then, see, I call myself a dinosaur, but I do like a keyboard. It would be very weird to see it just go away.
I agree.
There's some new rumors about what features are going to be included with the new Apple Watch. And I've seen more and more people wear these, too. They can directly connect to mobile networks. So what's going on with the Apple Watch now and what's going to change?
So Apple's big focus for the last version of the Apple Watch was fitness. Instead of being kind of a window into your phone for all of the things that you would do on your phone, Apple kind of, pivoted a little bit so that the focus there was very much on fitness, being able to work out in pretty much any environment and have that information be tracked and have that information be useful and also give you kind of notifications when it was necessary. The downside to this and every other smartwatch, for the most part, is that you still have to be pretty close to your phone in order for a lot of that stuff to work because it uses your phone as an internet connection. And several other smartwatch manufacturers have tried to resolve this by adding an LTE radio, so basically the same kind of cellular connection that your phone has. And that involves paying Verizon or AT&T or T-Mobile another $5 or $10 a month to give this thing kind of a separate connection. But it also enables the ability to make phone calls, and you can actually just use your watch and go for a jog or ride on your bike and not need your phone because you have kind of the basics handled through your watch. And so the big rumor now is that Apple is going to be doing the same thing this coming generation with the Apple Watch 3 by adding, you know, kind of that separate phone ability into the watch.
Does that mean the watch will be bigger?
You know, every other manufacturer that has done this has made the watch bigger because the battery required to run that radio is significantly more than just regular wireless or Bluetooth. And so, you know, Apple has a history of being just very clever when it comes to hardware design and not making things kind of unnecessarily large in order to support new features. And so it's the hope that they haven't compromised the design at all and making it the same thing. But that, you know, everything that we've seen up to this point suggests that, yes, it could possibly be slightly larger than the previous version.
And speaking of phones, Samsung has officially announced details about its new rugged smartphone, the Galaxy S8 Active. What does a rugged smartphone mean?
So this is something that Samsung does every year with the launch of their Galaxy S line. They released the Galaxy S line that everyone can buy, and then AT&T gets this bizarre little special edition that has really what looks like armor on the outside of it so that it can handle, you know, drops a little better and, you know, has a screen that is typically a little more durable and waterproof, which the last two versions of Samsung's phone has also been. And so this phone is really just kind of a little more durable than the Samsung Galaxy S8, but it also has a slightly faster processor and a little better battery life. So you know, if you like the Galaxy S8, but you wish it were a little more durable and a little more powerful and you're on AT&T, then this phone is going to be available to you at the end of the week, which is really kind of interesting because Samsung is planning on releasing an entirely separate phone for everyone at the end of this month called the Samsung Galaxy Note 8.
And is that going to have the same things as just for the AT&T folks? It's just now available for everyone?
No, the Galaxy Note phone is you know, much larger. It comes with a stylus for multitasking and a bunch of other different features. This Active phone is really kind of a unique thing to AT&T, and it frustrates a lot of people every year when it's unique to AT&T because there are people who would really prefer to have that bigger battery and more durable design, you know, kind of everywhere, not just on AT&T. But it's never been the two releases have never been this close together before. So it's really kind of interesting to see Samsung kind of work very quickly to release these two phones in such rapid succession.
Are people gravitating toward that bigger phone, that notebook size?
Up until last year, absolutely. And then last year they had this weird problem where they kept blowing up. but the big hope for Samsung this year is that there hasn't been a lot of traction lost for people who really enjoy that larger phone size. I don't think that there are more people, you know, kind of jumping ship from smaller phones to this every year. I think that's why Samsung keeps the Galaxy S8 phone, you know, kind of relatively small by comparison. And so this is for people who appreciate the larger phone with really kind of the biggest possible battery they can stick in there and a great camera. Is what they end up doing with the Galaxy Note phone.
Back to that other phone for a minute, the Galaxy S8 Active. Is this phone going to be bulky? I mean, not size-wise like a notebook phone, but just, you know, bigger around the edges and just not as sleek.
It will definitely be not as sleek. There are these kind of armor things. I keep referring to it as armor, but it's really just kind of durable plastic. That sits kind of on each of the four corners of the phone. So it is going to be slightly thicker, but really not by much. And it comes in, you know, several different color options for people who are interested. In the past, Samsung has done kind of very silly things and had the Active version of this phone come in different forms of camouflage. But this version so far, the more common color that we've seen so far is this just kind of jet black on the front and black, not back.
Well, Russell, thanks again. Russell Holly, thank you for joining us. Contributing editor at Android Central. Learned so much. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday. This is All Size with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.